You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, April 18th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape. Not in the literal nor metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building, nor in the Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Or at least I'm not there now. I'm traveling. Traveling to sunny Las Vegas. I'm going to pick up some of those foreclosed homes. And probably lose my shirt. And Milo's 529 at the craps table. However, I have not left you bereft of content. Indeed, an interview I did yesterday with Allison Kilkenny of The Nation magazine, of Mother Jones, and of course, Citizen Radio. And for members, you'll not only hear the Allison Kilkenny interview on the ongoings of Occupy Wall Street leading up to the May 1st May Day sort of general strike, general strike. You'll also hear from Ed Witkind. He is the president of the Transportation Trades Department of the AFL-CIO on this highway bill that Republicans are trying to vote on today. This is this highway bill is pretty important, and if something doesn't get passed, it could be pretty disastrous for our economy. Members enjoy that, and non-members, you'll get to enjoy, but just not as much enjoyment. Now, you could have more enjoyment in your life. That's by becoming a member at majority.fm. It's cheap. You get to feel good about yourself. You get swag. It's all good, folks. All right, here's that interview with Allison. And for members, stick around after the musical break. You'll also hear Ed Witkind. I will be live tomorrow from the Mass Torts Conference in Vegas. Not sure who we'll get down there, but hopefully we'll get some good interviews for you. Cliff Schechter will be in the house. So not in the house, actually. Well, I guess in the house is the gambling parlance in Vegas. So he will be in the house. And I will be losing to the house. All right, here's Allison Kilkenny.
Every day I get up and pray to John. And he increases the number of clocks by exactly one. Everybody's coming home for lunch these days. Last night there were skinheads on my lawn. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Some people say that bowling alley's got big legs.
It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Allison Kilkenny. She is a writer for The Nation magazine, Mother Jones, and also, of course, one of two hosts of Citizen Radio. I can't remember the other guy's name, but that's how I pronounce it. Allison, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Allison, so, all right, let's get updated on Occupy. I know less than, I guess, 2 weeks away from May 1st, the planned general strike. But before we get to that, first, give me an update. One of the things that I know at least in New York, what's been happening, and I think in a couple other occupations around the country, is this new practice of sleepful protest. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So, you know, for a while, occupiers were asking the question, can Occupy Wall Street still be Occupy Wall Street if they're not doing occupations? And it was a good question, but the answer they sort of came up with was that if they were going to do occupations, the occupation at Zuccotti, which sort of started the whole thing, was obviously tremendously important. But they decided if they were going to do something like that again, since this whole thing is about protesting Wall Street, they actually wanted to get on Wall Street and do it. So this was sort of an effort to do that. They were at Nassau Street, which is right by the Stock Exchange. So it was in a more appropriate spot where they could actually interact with business people, with tourists. They were much more visible. It was much more easy to understand why they were there, what they were symbolizing. So it grew over the week. It started with like 70 people, and then it became 80 people. And then as of last night, it was 100 people. And maybe it was because it was growing. You know, I don't want to speculate exactly to the exact motives of why the NYPD suddenly decided to break it up. But last night they started to make arrests. It sort of seemed like maybe there was a truce for a while this week between the NYPD and the protesters. At one point, an officer actually walked by and like threw up the peace sign to the protester. So it was really weird. Like the cops were being very nice and accommodating. And then last night, you know, all hell broke loose and they started to really, pretty violently arrest protesters. The number of protesters arrested varies depending on where you look. The New York Times said 5 people. The National Lawyers Guild said 12 people were arrested. And it was a really bizarre scene. You know, the residents around Wall Street came out and were screaming at the protesters. At one point, one of the residents physically attacked a protester. He actually tried to strangle him. And then the police bizarrely arrested the guy who was being strangled and not the man who attacked him, which was, you know, very strange that you can be arrested for being attacked by someone else. And yeah, so it remains to be seen. You know, the protesters said they're going to come back tonight. They're going to try to sleep there again. If that's going to be successful, we'll have to see. There's going to be a solidarity meetup tonight, this evening, at 5 o'clock down by Wall Street, to sort of show support for the people who were just arrested.
Now, we should just say that when you say last night, we're talking about Monday night, and tonight we're talking about Tuesday night, because we're going to play this on Wednesday.
Right.
And just to back up just a minute, what is a sleepful protest? In other words, there's no encampment being set up. People are simply sleeping on the sidewalk, and that, at least according to a 2000 court ruling, a New York court ruling, is perfectly legal under what circumstances?
Right. In 2000, it was decided in the New York courts that you are allowed to sleep on a public sidewalk as a form of political expression. So for protests and stuff like that. So that's what the protesters were sort of using as their armor when police would come by and say, hey, you guys have to leave. They were saying, no, this is a political protest. We're legally protected to do this. And then there were all kinds of like little technicalities where the police were saying, okay, you guys can be here, but you can't have like your stuff with you. You can't have clutter blocking entrances and stuff like that. So the protesters are really trying to work with the police and like accommodate pedestrians by keeping their stuff, you know, out of the pedestrians' way, trying to keep their sleep gear tidy. But apparently that wasn't enough, as we saw last night, Monday.
And of course, we're looking at a situation where you need to at least provide 50%. You can only sleep on 50% of the sidewalk. In other words, there needs to be 50% of the sidewalk so that pedestrians still can use it. And so this is really just harassment, isn't it? I mean, because they're going to we don't know how many exactly were arrested, but they're going to get in front of a judge, and a judge is going to say, based upon this ruling, you're not in violation of any city ordinance in any way. And so this is really just more about harassment and discouraging this protest.
Yeah, I mean, even when the police say, oh, it was because you were blocking pedestrian traffic, the way they arrest protesters is so arbitrary. Like, a couple days ago, I was at a protest and they started arresting people claiming it was because they were holding signs and they were on the steps when they were telling people to move. Except they arrest like five or six people, and then those left behind are also holding signs and they're also standing on the steps. So it's like, look, if the rule is that nobody can stand on the steps, then why didn't you arrest everybody? And it's just because they arrest enough people to break up the protest, to discourage people from coming out. You know, being arrested is a really unpleasant experience. And I think the police are banking on, if we arrest a handful of people and put them through the system, they'll go back to their friends and talk about like how awful it was. And, you know, it'll discourage people from coming out again in large numbers.
All right, and so let's this is ongoing. Let's talk about the preparation for the general strike. Or first, actually, before we get to that, the other day there was in New York City there was an anarchist book fair on Saturday, and following that, a crowd gathered in Washington Square Park for what they dubbed an anti-police march. Now, this is being and apparently they were employing black bloc tactics.
Mm-hmm.
This is being conflated, it seems to me, or perhaps maybe justifiably, maybe not. But I mean, to sort of in some way. Conflate it with Occupy Wall Street as a way of saying this is just more proof that Occupy Wall Street is just our violent anarchists only. And what is your, to the extent that you have any knowledge of this, what characterize that protest?
Well, the problem is that Occupy Wall Street's a big tent movement, which is part of the reason why it's so powerful. So it attracts a lot of people from really, you know, varying ends of the political spectrum. And that's a good thing, right? When you're building a coalition, you want to be able to attract the most people possible. But the downside of that is, you attract people who have really, really, really radical views. And that's the black bloc, the anarchists. And I do have to say that, there's a lot of anarchists and even people within the black bloc who don't do property damage. They aren't part of that sect. But there are a handful of people who, whenever something like this happens, they really want to get in the cops' faces. They really, you know, want to destroy property. That's what they're about. But it's not fair to characterize this as being an Occupy Wall Street action. You know, Occupy Wall Street has voted to remain a peaceful movement time and time again. And at this point, saying like Occupy Wall Street believes is sort of like saying human beings believe. Mm-hmm. Unless Occupy Wall Street actually votes on something at the GA and there's a consensus to say like, oh, Occupy Wall Street decided to break windows. That's just a completely inaccurate statement. Essentially, what you should say is a small group of people, some of which who might be from Occupy Wall Street, but who don't have the support of Occupy Wall Street.
Right. I mean, it's you're right. It's just simply a subset of people there. So let's talk about another aspect in terms of this big tent, which is that there have been ongoing meetings and basically spring training, it's been called, by a movement called the 99% Spring. And there has been quite a bit of a debate, at least amongst those who support Occupy and others, as to you know, is this a move to co-opt Occupy Wall Street? Just tell us about who the 99% spring is and what your sense is as to how helpful or detrimental to the Occupy movement this is.
Much like the Occupy Wall Street movement itself, the 99% spring thing is also comprised of a big coalition of lefty groups. So that includes MoveOn.org. And that's really the heart of the controversy right now, because obviously MoveOn.org historically has worked to elect people from the Democratic Party. And the worry among occupiers was that obviously they're trying to be an apolitical movement. They're trying to exist outside of, you know, the political parties so they can affect better change that way. And their concern was that MoveOn would sort of start to be like, oh, now we need to talk about reelecting President Obama. Right. And, you know, so there were a lot of occupiers who were a little weirded out at first, but I was actually quite impressed with, and I don't want this to sound condescending, but like the level of maturity of the protesters when I spoke with them, because they were really willing to hear out MoveOn.org and not freak out and become this really like isolated movement that eventually, you know, would die because it wasn't attracting new members. So the prominent Occupy activists I spoke with actually were really receptive of the idea of MoveOn getting involved. And maybe in a way, Occupy being able to co-opt MoveOn and like use their email lists and use their resources, because MoveOn.org is a really organized entity, and just sort of use the 100,000 people who are getting trained in direct action to come and support Occupy. And, you know, of course, there are a lot of occupiers out there who don't feel that way, but I spoke to a ton who are really excited about the idea of the 99% spring, who attended the training themselves and who reported back that there were no efforts to co-opt Occupy, that there was no mention of elections, no mention of reelecting President Obama, that there was just talk about like Cesar Chavez and like the history of direct action resistance. And the one protester I spoke with, Jesse Meyerson, was saying, you know, what's the downside of 100,000 people learning how to resist with direct action? Like, that's a really positive thing. Right. And if that's the way they're first introduced to Occupy Wall Street, he saw that as being a really positive thing.
Yeah, no, so we're talking about MoveOn. We're talking about AFL-CIO, Greenpeace, Working Families Party, 350.org, which is Bill McKibben's organization. Even Campaign for America's Future.
Some really like pretty radical lefty groups too, like the Rainforest Action Network, who have, you know, historically done some pretty radical direct action stuff. So it's not just like these middle of the road MoveOn.org type groups. There's some hardcore lefty groups who are involved too.
That's interesting. And so now, how do you think this is going to shake out? I didn't realize there were 100,000 people who have gone to these training sessions.
Well, I think that was the goal, that 100,000 people would be educated in direct action resistance. I don't know if they have an ongoing count going. I know a ton of people have done the training. And again, it's like, let's just say it's 2,000 people who Right. wouldn't have been educated about direct action resistance before. That's still 2,000 more people who now understand that, you know, how they can be empowered as citizens. And again, it's like, if there's no evangelizing going on behalf of the Democrats, that's a positive thing.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. I think, you know, the if this ends up being a gateway for MoveOn members, for union folk, for people who are have been intimidated in some respects by getting involved in Occupy Wall Street. If this is a gateway, it's a wonderful development. And as long as I think people go in with that type of perspective, this can be extremely helpful. So give me a sense of what your sense is as to what May Day is going to look like.
Yeah, well, May Day is going to be huge. We may see the mass arrests that we saw back in the day on the Brooklyn Bridge in New York. I know out in Oakland, those folks have some pretty in-your-face direct action stuff planned. So,
and we should say the last general strike in this country took place in Oakland. So there's a history there.
Yeah, and you know, the whole term general strike drew a lot of heat on Occupy Wall Street because general strikes are illegal. And there is no mass consensus among unions to go on strike. So to call it a general strike is a little misleading, but it's going to be a huge protest. Like, you know, that at the very least, we can say that some unions will be involved, some labor will be involved. The exact scale of it remains to be seen, but you know, Occupy Wall Street has really been advertising this for a very long time. And in my experience, when they pour that much, that many resources into advertising a single day like that, there's usually a pretty huge turnout.
Yeah. And what people are being asked to essentially disengage from. I mean, it's an interesting perspective on what they're looking for on May Day. It's not simply don't go to work necessarily. And my understanding is that there's also sort of, support services for people who are in precarious employment situations so that they can afford to take off work or so that they can figure out a way of expressing some type of solidarity without putting their employment in jeopardy because, I mean, that's the leverage point, isn't it? I mean, you know, the hardest thing to do in a situation where you're hanging on by your fingernails is to let go.
Totally. And like, it's really smart on the part of Occupy to do that because I've spoken to so many union workers who say like, I'm trying to get my union to vote on supporting Occupy Wall Street, publicly, and I just can't get them to vote on it. And there are so many workers like that. And then there are the workers who come by and like, you know, do the solidarity fist and say like, I'm with you guys, but I can't take a day off from work or I'll get fired. So there are so many, you know, there's a huge untapped pool of people like that who support Occupy privately. But they just, for whatever reason, can't take the day off. If they walked out, they would lose their job. So they're Occupy just tries to make the point, like there are many ways to support Occupy Wall Street. You don't have to like lose your job.
One of the things that I think is interesting is that my experience with, you know, Occupy happened at a time where there was this attempt sort of to institute the real rebuild the dream movement by Van Jones. And,
yeah.
You know, one of the things that I find sort of frustrating or I did prior, you know, at the time I think I spoke to Van Jones in July about this was the sort of the almost relentless refusal to isolate and to call out enemy may be a strong word, but you know, movements like this, there are villains out there, and naming them is a fairly important aspect of this because we're not protesting in a vacuum here. There are people, and none of this, none of the income inequality, none of the structures of society that are basically sending money to the top and creating this sort of almost two-tiered society. None of this is happening passively. There are people who are actually actively trying to create this outcome. At the very least, maybe they're not doing it on a wholesale level, but they're doing it on a retail level. And their incentive structure is different from the rest of the countries, frankly. And I'm curious as to, you know, has that come up, do you think, in as sort of the Occupy movement sort of melds, at least for the moment, with these folks? Has that bubbled up anywhere?
Yeah, a lot of Occupiers are super pissed off at Van Jones for a lot of reasons, stemming from the whole Reclaim the Dream thing, where I've had Occupiers make this point to me where they're like, what dream are we reclaiming? Like, what idealistic, made-up past of America is Van Jones hoping to reclaim? You know, if you just look at the history of our country, like progressives and like the civil rights movement have been fighting from day one for every, you know, right that they've obtained. So it's sort of like Occupy Wall Street is looking to a possible future where Van Jones is saying stuff like, we need to go backwards. We need to reclaim this dream that, you know, there's a reason Martin Luther King Jr. said, I have a dream. It was because it doesn't exist currently. It's in the future. That's why, you know, Occupy Wall Street is doing everything that it's doing. And Van Jones wrote this piece for The Nation that drew a lot of heat, where he was saying, you know, we're not, you know, picking on rich people. We know, like, you know, we need people to build those yachts, you know, like we need to create jobs, like to have yacht builders. And it was this really sad statement where it was like, the reason Occupy Wall Street was really exciting was because they did call out those people. They said, right, there is an enemy. It's the 1%. And here's why they're the enemy. They're bleeding the country dry. They're going to leave us all behind. They're taking everything. They're robbing us. And it's okay to say that. You know, there is a class war, but the 99% didn't start it. It's okay that they're acting defensively finally. And to have Van Jones, who's this really articulate, wonderful spokesperson, usually come out and say this really hurtful thing where it's sort of like, you know, you guys are being too harsh with your approach. It's like, no, that's the reason people were finally starting to get excited, because protests used to be these really sad exercises in futility where like people would show up with their sad little cardboard signs, march around for an hour and leave. And that's why nothing ever changed, you know, and there were reasons people did that, you know, that now they need to get permits and the cops really crack down on First Amendment rights. But Occupy Wall Street recognizes all of those barriers and still shows up, you know, still is extremely radical, quote unquote, as far as the history of lefty movements go in this country. And those were all good things. So it was disheartening to me to see somebody like Van Jones sort of like start to backpedal a little bit, because especially right now, I think we need to be pushing forward.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm not sure I would even characterize it as backpedal. I think that's sort of where he's always been in some respects. But, you know, one of the strengths of the Occupy movement, in my estimation, is that they are very much action oriented, as opposed to, in other words, you know, someone who's affiliated with Occupy the Homes, and he's done work with Direct Action before. He's also done some union work, and he said one of the amazing things about the most successful Occupy Your Homes people is that they're simply not territorial in the way that the institutional left is, and that they are willing to sort of say, like, we're going to go do this. If you want to join us, join us. We don't care who you are or what institution you're from. We don't have a notion of, you know, we need to do this mission to raise money for, you know, to be able to sell a pitch to our email list. This seems to me to be at least the Occupy, from what I've been reading of the Occupy protesters, they're taking the same tact on this. We've got something to achieve on May 1st, and it doesn't matter who's going to join us as long as that they're willing to do this action.
Yeah. I am a little concerned sometimes when the Occupy label is appropriated for events that are clearly, you know, sort of an arm of the Democratic movement.
Right.
Any protest, for example, that just targets Mitt Romney, that's always kind of a red flag where it's like, you know, are we working to reelect President Obama right now? Why are we just targeting Mitt Romney? If this is really about the 1%, you know, that includes both parties, Democrats and Republicans. But the territorial issue is an important one, because there is a danger, and I've learned this in speaking with some occupiers, of Occupy sort of becoming their hip little club, and they want to protect it. And that's a natural impulse, but it's also a great way to kill a movement by not accepting new enthusiastic people who may not be really, you know, hip to protest culture. You know, they may be like real newcomers who don't know a lot. And the sort of like eye rolling that goes on with that is a danger. Or people who used to work with the Democratic Party, or people who currently work with the Democratic Party but are like, I'm really not happy with how things are going, and can I work with you guys a little bit? It's important to accept those people as well. And I've been relieved to see that the majority of occupiers are super open to anybody coming along. And, you know, they're really receptive. They're really good at, you know, sort of getting people up to speed about what's been going on. They're good ambassadors for the movement. So that's good just in terms of, you know, the future of the movement.
And so if people want to figure out how they can get involved on May 1st, where are the best places online for people to get some resources in that regard?
So the best website you can go to for the Occupy Wall Street schedule and all of their actions is their official website. So that's just nycga.net. And then I think at the top of the page, there's a tab for events. And they have a really nice schedule laid out of their group meetings and their actions. And that's the best way. You can also, I think, sign up at the website for email alerts and stuff like that.
Great. And then what do you know about maydaynyc.org?
That sounds like the official website for May Day. And I'm going to it right now. It's from the Direct Action Working Group of the New York City General Assembly. So that is the official May Day website. So if you're looking for any information about strikes or street actions, or if you just want to see the history of May Day, that's also up there. So that looks like the new centralized location of everything that's going to be going down May 1st.
Great. It's maydaynyc.org. Allison Kilkenny, say hi to... Jamie, right? Is it Jamie?
Yeah, I will.
Okay, great.
He sends love and kisses.
Oh, that's very sweet of him. All right, Allison, thanks so much for joining us. Of course, Citizen Radio. We are citizenradio.com.
Com, yep.
And of course, In the Nation and sometimes Mother Jones as well. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And I will pay.